Hello, this time on SITREP, we are not at war, but we are under attack.
These attacks on critical national infrastructure, Russian aircraft buzzing our airspace on a regular basis, cyber attacks every day. This is happening now.
As well as that warning from the Deputy Chief of Defence Staff, grey zone attacks have been making frequent headlines. It's not just in cyberspace or apparent spying by mysterious drones over American air bases in the UK and near HMS Queen Elizabeth. And it's not just disruption from yet more undersea communication cables being cut. Western intelligence claims a series of suspicious cargo fires across Europe were test runs for a plan to down a transatlantic jet, and that they foiled an assassination plot against the head of Germany's biggest arms maker. So, this week we ask, if attacks like these are deemed sub-threshold, where is the threshold of war? And have our leaders even drawn up any red lines to mark the limits of the grey zone?
SITREP with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
From deniable disruption and destabilisation to full-on sabotage and murder, sub-threshold attacks are nothing new. But Mike, the tempo seems to have soared.
Yes, it does, particularly in the last year to 18 months for reasons that we're all fairly well aware of. And what this does, and I think this is understood certainly inside officialdom, I'm not sure if inside our political community, but in officialdom, they know that it challenges our previous assumptions that there was a difference between war and peace. Because in peace, you could live with lots of disruption, you could live with lots of aggravation, but it wasn't war. When you cross the threshold to war, then lots of other things happen. Mobilization of some sort starts. Extraordinary resources have to be devoted. And that was a very clear psychological threshold and always has been, you know, since 1945. And I think officials understand that threshold has basically evaporated. So it's now a very wavy line, this line now between war and peace. And politically, that's really hard to get hold of. And it's really hard to, as it were, to talk about it publicly without frightening the public. And that's why politicians prefer not to talk about it.
Well, in a while, we'll get the thoughts of a former military intelligence officer and the new chairman of the Commons Defence Committee. But first, let's bring in Elizabeth Brough, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, specialising in grey zone and hybrid threats. Elizabeth, good to see you again. Welcome to SITREP. Thank you for joining us. The grey zone, hybrid warfare, sub-threshold attacks, these terms cover a very broad range of hostile actions that we have seen, from propaganda on social media to targeted killing attempts with a chemical weapon in Salisbury. Does that pretty much span the full range, or does it get worse?
It's pretty much spans the full range that we have seen to date, but of course our adversaries keep innovating, so that range keeps getting populated by new forms of grey zone aggression that they come up with. And by the way, this is why I use the term grey zone aggression, because it really is the grey zone between war and peace. We know that it's not peace, and we know that it doesn't look right, but since these are not acts of war as we understand war to be, meaning action by hostile armed forces against our armed forces or our countries, then we struggle to respond. So what we've seen in the past 2-3 years is accelerating innovation in the grey zone, simply because geopolitical tension has increased and because acting in the grey zone is so attractive to our adversaries. They can keep innovating, coming up with new tools against our countries, and they can do it with impunity because we don't have any red lines or thresholds above which we say, well, this is not acceptable. And now, just mentioned one more thing. When I started the Grey Zone program at RUSI a number of years ago, I was on a show like this and talked about why we needed different defense against it and different deterrents. And another guest on that show said, well, why would we need to come up with something new? We have nukes. I sort of thought, well, this is a totally nonsensical argument, but it illustrates why the traditional deterrence we've had doesn't work. Because if you threaten to nuke a cyber attacker, clearly the cyber attacker will say, well, I know you're not going to nuke me, so I keep doing it, which is what we've been seeing over these past few years.
Okay, let's break down the types of attack and how close they might come to red lines. Mike, is it fair to say that actions around information, be it misinformation or intelligence from drones flying near our aircraft carrier, are probably always going to be well away from any red lines that prompt hard-edged military action?
Yes, I think so. I mean, obviously, drones flying around aircraft carriers invite the response that you either bring them down or you somehow jam them. But in general, the information competition is one that is very sub-threshold. It is well away from the general threshold of war because it's regarded as fair game in a way. All sides compete for the narrative, as they say these days. What's different now, I think, in the information space is that whereas Western powers, they do, you know, we do by and large, most of the time, really try to tell the truth as we understand it. There is a genuine effort to get the truth out there as we see it. What our opponents are doing increasingly is not just telling their version of events. They try to create cynicism. They try to create disillusionment. They try to create confusion so that ordinary people just give up thinking about it. And cynicism, it turns out to be a very useful political weapon. And that's something that's relatively new in the whole information warfare, which goes back, you know, at least 100 years or so. And that's very worrying for the West because it's quite hard to combat sheer cynicism and disillusionment. And it's very easy to create it.
Yes, Elizabeth, that information space covers one element of cyber, restricted effectively to cyberspace itself. But then you have cyber attacks, which affects the physical world. We hear those warnings that our power and water supplies could be cut off by a really serious cyber attack. Briefly, is that the worst it could get, or is there even more at stake?
I think it doesn't even have to get to successful attacks on our infrastructure. And by the way, there have been successful cyber attacks, including against the NHS and indeed the entire Irish health service that have resulted in the loss of life. But just the mere threat of cyber attacks against critical national infrastructure is enough to cause people, citizens, to lose faith in our institutions. And that's why it's so powerful. So you can just openly suggest that you may target our critical national infrastructure, water plants, power plants, and so forth. And that will cause fear among the population. And along those lines, we saw in Finland this summer and in Sweden a string of break-in attempts into water plants. We don't know yet who was behind them, but this is exactly the sort of thing that causes fear among the population. So it leads to societal deterioration.
So, Mike, specifically, though, Elizabeth there mentioned attacks that have taken place against the UK. Could a cyber attack or be serious enough, an actual one, to take us across that threshold of war or at least lead to a physical military response?
Well, I mean, NATO has grappled with this one for many years now, thinking about, you know, do cyber attacks constitute a potential Article 5 infringement, an attack on the physical integrity of a state? And by and large, NATO's answer was, well, no, it doesn't. But I think that answer has changed in more recent years, because certainly if a cyber attack caused death, say by bringing down an aircraft or causing rail crashes, or if it caused death by attacking a health service so that the public could see that members of the public are being killed because of cyber attack, then I think that is right on the war threshold, because clearly you are being attacked in a way that causes violence. And I think now cyber power is so great and its potential is so great that cyber power that causes actual violence is now absolutely plausible. And so, yes, I think cyber attacks now at the top end can come under the, you know, into that even the old-fashioned war threshold, that we are being attacked, our people are being killed because of a cyber attack.
And on the old-fashioned physical sabotage, at the lower end, just last month, a man pleaded guilty to an arson attack against a Ukrainian-owned business in London. Much more serious-seeming are these mysterious parcel fires across Europe, all on the same day, that Western intelligence agencies say look like a trial run of an attempt to bring down a transatlantic jet. Elizabeth, if they are right, why would Russia want to do something like that, and what would they gain from it?
Again, that is a way of causing fear in our societies, causing people to lose faith in our institutions. But when it comes to the parcel bombs that were found, and now we should add, I think, that they were found in a DHL depot in Leipzig in Germany, and now a DHL plane flying from Leipzig has crashed. We don't know the cause yet, but it sort of adds to this saga. And with that, whoever is behind it, these parcels, is demonstrating that not even companies, totally commercial companies that don't represent the government, not even they are safe. Now they are no longer neutral. They are considered fair game.
Mike, I'm just wondering, is Russia trying to push us to the brink or at least test our tolerance for these kind of threats and attacks? Because if we take an example from the 1980s, the US carried out missile strikes against Libya in response to the bombing of a Berlin nightclub popular with American soldiers. Three people, including two Americans, died in that attack and more than 200 were injured. If Russia were to bring down a transatlantic jet, that looks like a comparable atrocity, and therefore, Mike, in theory, would merit a comparable response.
It might these days. It did happen. I mean, the first time I went to America to work in September 1983, the Korean airliner had just been brought down. It was the KAL 007, astonishingly. That was its flight number, 007. And it had been brought down by a Russian fighter over the Kamchatka Peninsula. Now, that Korean airliner had flown from the United States, from New York to Anchorage, and it was over Kamchatka when it lost its way. It went over Russian missile fields, and the Russians brought it down and killed 260-odd people. And when I got to the States, that was all over the news. But at the time, the sense was it was an accident. It was a dreadful accident. The Russians should have reacted differently, but it was not covered up, but it was accepted as a tragic accident. I'm not sure that would be the case today, because as soon as you establish red lines, as we keep talking about, what are our red lines? Once you say what they are, then the aggressor state, and we are talking about Russia as an aggressor state now, goes right up to those red lines and pushes on them to see how far they really go, how deep they are. And so, yes, the Russians are testing us all the time to see when are we going to hit back or stand up against these mini pinpricks against our red lines. And if we don't, they'll keep on pushing.
Well, let's pause to get the thoughts of someone who was hands-on with addressing these kinds of threats for many years. Colonel Philip Ingram, former commander of 1 Military Intelligence Battalion.
Well, we're seeing an awful lot more of it now. There was probably a lot of reconnaissance going on around these sorts of things when I was in uniform, but none of the direct action that we're seeing and is getting reported. So a massive increase in this sort of activity, because it's a disruptive activity. It's disruptive in that it's threatening the West, it's threatening our very critical infrastructure. It's also giving hostile organizations and countries the ability to monitor how we react and therefore give them a better understanding of our real vulnerabilities should they want to turn these sorts of operations into the precursor for a larger conflict, which is something the UK has got a history of. We were the first people to deal with undersea cables as an opening gambit of a conflict back at the beginning of the First World War, when we cut 4 of the 5 telegram cables that went across the channel, leaving a fifth one open, which just happened to go through the UK, which just happened to be tapped into, which enabled us to intercept the Zimmerman telegram and brought the Americans into the First World War. So this is nothing new.
And what we see publicly in response to sub-threshold actions is generally diplomatic punishments, for example, after the Novichok attack in Salisbury. Visible defence responses are rare and tend to be deterrent. So, for example, the Royal Navy tracking the Russian spy ship Yantar recently. Do you know, are there harder defence responses that happen perhaps in the shadows that we don't hear about?
Oh, there's lots of defence that goes on in the shadows that we don't hear about. But you have to remember that defence is an arm of diplomacy. So it is a diplomatic tool. And therefore, we usually associate defence with war fighting. There's an awful lot more activity that goes on to stop us getting to war fighting, to help that diplomacy that's going on in the background. So shadowing Russian submarines, shadowing Russian ships, warning them off from attacking different infrastructure, because we're letting them know that we know that they're there and that they're within a firing solution. The same with the RAF intercepting long-range Russian bombers and other things. So defence here is being used in its diplomatic deterrence role, and that's an appropriate activity for it.
And we talk about hybrid and grey zone actions as being sub-threshold, below the threshold of war. But where does that threshold actually sit? Is it clear what our red lines as a country are to sabotage activities?
It's not clear. That is a political decision as to what our government would consider an act of war. So it's that activity that a government would consider an act of war and therefore declare war against another nation. That is that that piece that would say you've gone from sub-threshold activity through above-threshold activity. But that's a political decision that I don't think anyone could define until something actually happens.
Is that political decision taken on a case-by-case basis when things happen? Or do our politicians know where those red lines are but just aren't telling us?
The main red line for our politicians is NATO Article 5. So an attack on one is an attack on all. But what that attack is defined as is a political decision that NATO countries will agree on. That's the clearest red line we've got. Any other red line is a national political red line that probably in many cases hasn't been set and is something that will be debated. Of course, if there was a direct military attack against a military base or political centre in the United Kingdom by a hostile nation, that would almost certainly cross the red line. But I have to say almost certainly Parliament would have to come to a consensus on this.
And is there more you think we could be or should be doing in response to sub-threshold attacks?
I think there's a lot more. I think that as a country, not just the MOD, but all of the other areas of the country haven't really focused on capabilities to monitor sub-threshold attacks, to mitigate sub-threshold attacks, and to protect against sub-threshold attacks. And that's why we're very vulnerable in that area. There needs to be a massive investment, and this is something that I hope the Strategic Defence Review looks at, because we're under sub-threshold attacks on a daily basis.
And you mentioned, Philip, about defence being used for deterrence. What about preventing these kind of attacks? Is there more that we could and should be doing?
There's an awful lot more that we could and should be doing. You know, the deterrence bit will only work if you put preventative measures in place. And that prevention can be more capability to monitor our critical national infrastructure, our undersea cables and undersea pipelines, more in the cyber arena, looking at attacks against our critical national infrastructure, more to deter the drone attacks that we're seeing against US airfields, more capable to detect and identify where these are being flown from very quickly. And there's a massive plethora of sub-threshold attacks. I would hope that the Strategic Defence Review is looking at capability that's needed to do that, because we're being attacked on a daily basis.
Former military intelligence officer, Colonel Philip Ingram. Philip mentioned there are lots of defence that goes on in the shadows. Mike, any idea how much the UK and its allies might be using their military capabilities in the shadows, fighting fire with fire?
Yeah, there's two ways of doing it on the deterrence basis. One is deterrence by counterattack, as it were, and you've got to be very careful how you use that, because it can go wrong and it can create a sense that you're just as bad as the aggressor. So you've got to be careful what you try to attack in response. But then there's deterrence by denial, just making it so difficult that the other side gives up trying. And then you add to deterrence by offense and deterrence by denial, resilience. You've got to be more resilient. But to do that, as Philip said, you need a whole of society approach. And the problem is, throughout the Western world, we don't really have a whole of society approach, but our opponents do. And the Russians and the Chinese have a whole of society approach to the way in which they attack us on a sub-threshold basis. And technically, they're going to pull ahead of us in the next 10 years, just in sheer technological terms. So we haven't got a lot of time to develop the sort of the suite of capabilities that we need across the board in Western countries and within the Western alliance. It's already, as it were, the right end of the wrong time to be doing it.
And Elizabeth, that deterrence that Mike mentions is obviously the ideal, but are we actually managing to deter them at all at the moment?
Well, deterrence is about psychology. We don't know what we are managing to deter, because we don't know whether what is not happening because we deterred it or because they decided they weren't going to do it in the first place. And that is the frustration, I think, about deterrence, that you can never really measure it until afterwards. And on that note, it's just a massively regrettable that after the Cold War, contemporary historians didn't interview Soviet leaders and other Warsaw Pact leaders to find out what had deterred them, because that could have given us lessons for today. But the reality is, we don't know what deters. We just have to keep trying, and we'll never know what goes on inside the heads of the people on the other side. But deterrence by denial is I think, a very productive avenue, simply because it's good to have it anyway. It's not offensive, it's not escalatory, it's just essentially shoring up our defences here so that it becomes less easy for the other side to wreak havoc.
Well, as Philip Ingram mentioned, we've got a defence review going on at the moment, and all that we're discussing will be a significant strand of the work for that review. The Commons Defence Committee also has an inquiry underway into defence in the grey zone. The committee is chaired by the Labour MP, Tan Desi.
Look, Kate, what we're seeing is more and more attacks, things happening beneath the threshold, whereby states or other nefarious actors can just pretend that it wasn't them. So that is why we need to realise that our British troops aren't out there in an overt or explicit the conflict at present. And a lot of this is actually within the grey zone. So that is why that particular inquiry is incredibly important. We will, I hope, touch wood, very, very soon publish the findings of that inquiry. And no doubt we will come back to these themes because they are becoming increasingly important. We've seen how it's impacting not just our nation's defence, but our democracy. The levels of disinformation, of misinformation on social media, on the internet, which actually affects our electorate. So if we want to defend our way of life, if we want to defend our democracy, we need to concentrate on what's happening within that grey zone.
And the Deputy Chief of Defence Staff has told you that grey zone or sub-threshold attacks are happening to us now, every day. And attacks can range from disinformation to, as we saw in 2018, a chemical weapon attack with Novichok on British soil. Our responses, at least in public, remain limited to things like sanctions and diplomatic expulsions. Is that enough?
Well, look, diplomacy has a huge part to play in it, but also deterrence, so having suitable deterrence in place, and to ensure that we have the technology. So we are harnessing, for example, AI, the full scope of that, and also working not just with companies from across the world, but also our allies. How we may be able to rely on others for certain specialisms, learning from them and from best practice, but then also giving some of our best practice to some of our, whether it's our NATO allies or others across the globe, because I think that's very, very important. And more, Kate, it's becoming about alliances.
And in terms of a grey zone attack, where is, in your view, the threshold for an enemy action to require a physical response, not just words and diplomatic blowback?
But that ultimately is a decision for the government. It won't be for the chair of the Defence Committee or indeed any of our other committee members. The government has to take on board what it is seeing at that point in time. Obviously, I can't comment on hypothetical situations, but the government seeing the situation at that time, they no doubt will have to ensure that there is a befitting response. And as and when any such decisions are taken, no doubt we in Parliament will be scrutinising those decisions.
Western intelligence says three air freight parcel fires in one day in the summer were part of a Russian test run to attack a transatlantic jet. If a jet were to be attacked and brought down that way, should it be treated as an act of war?
Look, it's incredibly important that we treat each threat very, very seriously. And we were shocked, but not surprised, to hear about such activity. And I am sure that at the right time, depending on the gravity of the situation and depending on the extent of what is there, that is when ministers will take the appropriate decision in consultation with the Prime Minister.
And how should we and our NATO allies strike the balance, do you think, between avoiding escalation and not being seen as weak and powerless?
Well, we can never seem weak because otherwise that's how bullies act. So the likes of Putin are not interested in cordial conversation, the only way that you can deal with a bully is to stand up to them. That's something that I've learned, whether it's on a personal level, but I think as on a national level, we need to make sure that we have that safety and security through strength, defense through strength, because if our adversaries know that we are strong, we have the necessary deterrence in place, they are less likely to engage in negative or nefarious activities.
Tan Desi, great to speak to you. Thank you so much for spending time with us on SITREP.
Thank you, Kate.
And Tan Desi is just a few weeks into that job, chairing the Commons Defence Committee. We talk about what he wants to do for servicemen and women and what he brings to the job in an extra edition of the SITREP podcast online now. Elizabeth, I should also note here, you were the first person to give evidence to that grey zone inquiry for the Defence Committee. Tan Desi says there, you have to stand up to bullies. It's hard not to wonder after the Salisbury poisonings and before that, the polonium attack, which assassinated Alexander Litvinenko in London. Have we really done anything to stand up to that kind of murderous bullying on our own soil?
The response to the Salisbury attacks was really quite impressive. So the UK government did marshal our allies and collectively the various Western countries that came to the support of the UK expelled a great number of Russian diplomats. The UK also cut off various access to financial services in the UK for various Russian entities. And there's a significant blow to the Russian economy. So that was an impressive response, but that was a sort of a one-off. And I think it was a one-off simply because that attack was so dramatic. You can't just say, well, oof, sorry that happened. It's just the nature of the grey zone aggression. The UK government did have to respond. And another aspect of that was the speed at which UK media, I don't know whether it was in cooperation with the government or totally on its own, but identified those two suspects. And as we all know, they then became subjects of ridicule. And that is not an insignificant part of the response. But one would wish that sort of forceful response would happen on other occasions too, and indeed that the UK would signal on a regular basis, if you try anything, we will come up with an innovative package that will hurt you, and it will be ethical, it will be legal, and it will be something that complies with our obligations as a liberal democracy that adheres to the rules-based international order, but it will hurt you.
And briefly, Elizabeth, do we see any evidence, though, of ever doing anything to deter Russia from doing this again or doing more?
Not in the public domain. And if it's not in the public domain, how is the public going to know that the government is doing anything? Now, granted, there could be things happening that those of us in the public domain don't know about, but a lot of deterrence is about signalling, and that signalling has to happen in public. It has to be directed against Russia and any other country wishing to harm us, but also come to the attention of the public so that the public knows when something happens, including undersea cables being cut or parcel bombs being placed in aviation depots. The public knows that the government is, whatever government it is, but in this case the UK government, that it's not being totally passive. And I think this is where this current government and indeed the former government could do more. And then what I would love to see is resilience training of the wider population, more collaboration with the private sector in grey zone exercises so that companies know what to do. And indeed, ordinary citizens know what to do if some sort of disruption happens.
Elizabeth Brough, great to speak to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Mike, let's take a moment to put all of this into historical context, because mentioning the Novichok and polonium attacks there, more senior members of the SITREP family may well also be thinking of Waterloo Bridge in 1978 and a deadly attack with an umbrella.
Yes, Georgi Markov. He was a member of the BBC World Service and I think BBC Monitoring. And he left his work that evening in 1978 and went to the bus stop on Waterloo Bridge and was stabbed in the leg by a poisonous umbrella tip. And that was wielded by a member of the Bulgarian Secret Service, we all knew afterwards, on behalf of Russia. And he died. And that was an assassination, an overt assassination on the streets of London against somebody who was telling the truth about the nature of the Soviet system at the time. And although there was a lot of disquiet about it, it was regarded as just about, not acceptable, but just about tolerable, because murders did take place in London. Calvi, the Italian banker, was murdered by the mafia and strung up under Blackfriars Bridge at about the same sort of time. You know, these things did happen, and it wasn't regarded as somehow crossing the line, but it was well remembered, and I remember it very well. Georgi Markov, yeah, very sad story.
Yeah, indeed. And these disruptive, destabilizing, deniable attacks, sub-threshold, are they as old as war itself?
Yes, they tend to be. I mean, assassination has always been one technique of attack, and it usually corresponds with a build-up to war or as part of a war, but you shouldn't be surprised by them. You may be shocked by the individual circumstances, but it's not surprising. And in a way, I don't say we've got to tolerate them, but I think we've got to factor them into the picture, because the picture all around us is darkening, and I think we can expect more of this, certainly more assassination attempts, which are very obvious at the moment across our society.
And while we're talking about history, the last of your podcast series, Great British Battle Commanders, dropped this week. Who are you talking about this time?
We're doing a Nelson this week. So looking at Nelson, who took with him to Trafalgar two big ideas. One was that he was fighting for the strategic future of Britain, and two, that he wouldn't be coming back from Trafalgar. And he turned out to be right on both counts.
And you can watch now on the BFBS Forces News YouTube channel, or search Great British Battle Commanders wherever you get your podcast to hear the whole series, including the final episode, Nelson, Legend Forged in Battle.
As a lieutenant in the 1780s, he was quite admired by the lower decks. But that, I think that charisma grew in time with his confidence. And certainly by the time he was an admiral or vice admiral at Trafalgar, he was adored by his men. And they wept openly at his death.
Dowding basically designs all this system with a clear strategic vision, yes. And he makes it work.
Absolutely, he makes it work, and he isn't afraid to go against some of the political opinion and military opinion to do so.
I share Wellington's admiration for the British soldier. And when he said the brave is the finest, I believe him. As he said, they get me out of trouble. They did at Waterloo.
The Roman army was a professional, disciplined force. Boudicca's forces, by contrast, would have consisted of a nucleus of warriors. But a lot of her forces were basically farmers.
The great thing about Monty, in many respects, I'd say the most important thing, is he had a really good feel for what his troops could do.
Mike, what are you going to do now? The podcast's complete, the book's published. Have you got a new book to start once Christmas lunch is over?
Yeah, the day after Boxing Day, actually. I'm starting. The working title is Britain's Women of Command. Because I've written about some of the female commanders in this book. But, you know, there are more to talk about, some of the Celtic and the Saxon warrior queens. There are also women who were not officially in command, but find themselves through force of circumstances taking command of military forces. And then there's a number of women who were intrinsically part of their husband or their lover's command, or who were confidants to commanders. So there were women who had an effect on male commanders, not always benign, but usually. So I'm starting on a little study of women, British women in command in different ways. And that's the day after Boxing Day. That starts.
I love the way you say a little study, but I guess you won't be down the shops then taking advantage of the sales. Mike, get to it, get to work. Thank you so much for your time. And thanks to all of our guests. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. Until then, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for joining us. Bye for now.